It's a great time to save big on everything for your next project at Menards. Get free estimates fast on new energy-efficient windows from Jeld-Wen. Choose from vinyl or wood windows and customize the perfect size and unique features for your home. Save big on all Jeld-Wen windows today. View our entire selection of Jeld-Wen windows on Menards.com. Plus, the weekly flyer for other great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Now playing Open Floor.
This is Open Floor.
Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix back at it.
An NBA podcast with Sports Illustrated senior writer.
I think it's time that the world get to know
my guy Chris Mannix.
I think your opinion is shared by everyone.
And now it begins.
Now it begins. Bang!
All right, Mark Medina, Sports Kita, Fox Sports Radio, longtime NBA journalist. Before we get into what I want to talk about today, which includes Minnesota, Boston, some stuff about the Lakers coaching search, I do have to say this. I woke up on Wednesday morning in Dallas, and populating my timeline was an ESPN clip that was debating the friendship of Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, debating the relationship between Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, and the evidence that was being used to suggest that maybe Tatum and Brown weren't as connected as they'd like people to think was the scene after the conference finals ended where Jaylen Brown was named conference finals MVP. The clip showed Jason Tatum smiling. The clip showed Jason Tatum laughing, but somehow, some way, the cast of characters on ESPN decided to make it a point of discussion that maybe Tatum wasn't happy for Brown, and maybe there is some kind of disconnect between Tatum and Brown. I gotta tell you, Mark, it felt like I was in a time warp. It felt like it was 2019 all over again, and Tatum and Brown were young players. Anthony Davis was available. Kawhi Leonard was available, and we were talking about breaking up these two stars. Not 5 years later, when they've gone now to two finals in 3 years and are going to be a favorite against whoever they face in the NBA finals. I don't even know what the question is for you, Mark. I'm just saying, like, I can't believe we're actually doing this in 2024.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, this is a conversation that was to be had when they're running up in the Eastern Conference Finals and losing to LeBron James with the Cleveland Cavaliers. So I think by my count, people have broken up the Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown duo for about 394 times already. And clearly the Celtics have not done that. They've recommitted to them. They've built around them. They've shown that they're improved players. They can coexist. They can be more efficient while still doing what they do best. So yeah, that is not a storyline, but that's not going to prevent certain people from talking about it to make it a storyline.
The Tatum-Brown relationship is, it is the definition of beating a dead horse, right? Look, I've written about Jason Tatum multiple times, done a couple of profiles on him in the magazine. I've written about their relationship most recently in 2000 and I think early 2022 when we put the three guys on the cover of the magazine. And I talked to a lot of people around them for that story. And to a man, they all said that they have a really good relationship. Now, they are very different people, right? Like, Jaylen Brown is, their personalities are different. Their off-court interests are very different. But they're friends. Like, they are friends. They hang out. They are not just finishing games and getting into cars and not seeing each other. The relationship between these two guys is fine. And the on-court relationship between these two guys is frigging great. Like, they are two of the best wings in the NBA right now. And I promise you, I don't know where winning conference finals MVP is on Jason Tatum's priority list, but it's probably somewhere between what I'm going to have for breakfast and what kind of toilet paper to buy at the grocery store. I don't think he's overly concerned with who wins conference finals MVP, Mark. So I get that when you're programming a 24-hour sports news channel, you got to find things to talk about. I get it. I've been part of that. But This is not a story. It's not a topic. And using a clip where Tatum was smiling and clapping and suggesting that because he didn't smile harder and clap harder, that it was somehow an indication of a disconnect is beyond me. So I don't know if you have anything to add there before we move on, but that was my spiel.
Yeah, Chris, I'll add this because under the spirit that I don't want to beat a dead horse either, but you know, the relevant wrinkle to this season specifically is Kristaps Porzingis' arrival and just the effect that that's had. And I remember talking to him earlier in the season about what's been the key and being able to fit in so seamlessly. And he said, it starts with Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. They've made me more comfortable to be able to be that facilitator, help run the offense, be a complementary scorer. And as a result of that, you've seen Jason Tatum's assist numbers go up. You've seen Jaylen Brown's efficiency go up. The chemistry among all those three players have also been good. Now, as it pertains to the playoffs, obviously we have a lot of questions about KP's injury status and when or if he's going to return. But as it ties into what you're talking about with their dynamic, their chemistry, you add another third player into that mix that is a really good part of that. And he's saying, yeah, they are responsible for why I felt like I've been so successful seamlessly with this team. That further illustrates this isn't a story anymore, guys. They get along fine. They mesh well together fine, and it's going to be okay. The only thing that could derail the Celtics is if there's health concerns or if just the fact that because presumably Dallas is going to get to the finals, they're just playing at an unbelievable level. But it's not going to be because Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum don't like each other or don't work well together, because they clearly do on both fronts.
All right, so I want to get back to the Celtics and the legitimate questions that there are about them and how vulnerable they are going into a final series. But let's talk about the teams that are vying to get there. I was at game four of Dallas against Minnesota on Tuesday night. Great effort by the Timberwolves. Great bounce back game from Karl Anthony Towns. I mean, I was among the people that crushed Towns after game three because he just became this one-dimensional three-point shooter and didn't look like he had the proper level of physicality to compete in a series like this. He flipped the script in game four. He was aggressive. He got to the basket. Second half of this game, he scored 20 of his 25 points. Most of those points came when he had five fouls, Mark. Like, he played through significant foul trouble really for the last three quarters of this game and really put that team on his back for chunks of it before Edwards could take over and made some big shots down the stretch. So we know, Mark, that no team in NBA history has ever come back from a 3-0 deficit. The Minnesota got its first win here. Now they head back home trying to get another. Is the door open in your mind for Minnesota to pull off something historic?
I don't think so, Chris. I respect the fact that they won a game. They did do 1-2-3 Cancun. They extended the series. They gave themselves life. But I can't see them suddenly becoming the only team after 154 teams failed to overcome an 0-3 deficit to now become the exception. I also don't think they'll become the fifth team to force a game seven after being down 3-0. I think that this is a gentleman's sweep. I think that, yes, we give a lot of credit to Karl Anthony Towns having a bounce back performance, being more aggressive at the rim, not just settling for threes. But I think in Dallas's case, Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving didn't shoot the ball well. They missed. Yeah, and Derek Lively II, his injury and his absence obviously was a game changer because of just how great he has been as a defender. And that has partly explained why earlier in the series, Minnesota was settling for a lot of outside shots. I think that they should have been more aggressive with attacking in the basket, but also didn't help that they knew Lively's presence there can do a lot of damage. So I think that Dallas will win game five. They'll advance to the NBA finals, and that's that. But I think that when you look at the big picture of this series, there's a few things here. I thought that they could carry the momentum from the seven-game series against Denver because of the fact that they're the defending champs, they're playing at all-time level. But I think that we saw that the matchup dynamics are just different. The Wolves, because of Tim Connelly, they constructed this roster to match up with Denver. Dallas's identity is completely different because they got Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving as perimeter scoring threats. That's number one. And number two, I was just very confounded that all of a sudden fatigue hit Anthony Edwards when he's 22 years old. I was surprised that all of a sudden Karl Anthony Towns is not becoming that versatile player that made him a good center. He's just settling for threes. I'm with you that all this cottage industry content spearheaded by Draymond Green and others to punch bags of Rudy Gobert is unfounded. Like, he's a great defensive player, but you know, that game two game winner that Luka had, like, I didn't see that coming. So I thought this would be more competitive, but I think in fairness, what we've seen with Dallas is that Luka's raised his game to another level. It's more efficient. He's not complaining as much to the referees. He's trusting his teammates more. And Kyrie Irving has shown that he is that perfect complement to Luka. Their on-court chemistry seamless, and he's allowed to be that, you know, veteran locker room presence because Luka's less experienced and he doesn't have that kind of dynamic personality that Kyrie has. And then the last thing is they just have a better supporting cast than they've had in seasons past, most notably led by PJ Washington being a good two-way player, Derek Lively the second being a good defensive player. So I think that we've just seen Dallas is no longer that team that can just get to the playoffs and they'll just flame out because they only have Luka. This is a team that's constructed to win.
Okay, I'm not ready to hot take it and say the Timberwolves are going to win this series, but I do think the door is open here. I think they're going to get game five. The last time we saw Minnesota at home in elimination game, they blew the doors off of Denver, won by like 112 points or something. I stopped counting in like the third quarter. I think they get game five, and then I think game six is high noon for this series. I think that is the knockdown, drag out, must win game, kind of for both teams, because I'm not sure that Dallas would win a game seven back in Minnesota. Look, the questions that are outstanding begin with Derek Lively. Is he going to be available in game five? I thought Gafford was excellent for most of the game. He doesn't really have a lot of help behind him there. You know, Dwight Powell is getting some of those Derek Lively minutes, and he hasn't been very good in those minutes that he's gotten. They need Derek Lively. And Derek Lively, man, like, I've seen heavyweight boxers take softer shots, man. Like, Derek Lively was on the deck for, you know, for minutes. And then when he got up, needed help getting to the locker room. The fact that we haven't heard officially he's in the concussion protocol is insane to me. Like, if Derek Lively's not in the concussion protocol, I don't know what the concussion protocol is for, honestly. Like, he took a knee from a 7-foot, 250-pound big man directly in the back of the head. That's how you get concussions. I'm not trying to be a doctor here, but that's what a concussion ultimately looks like. Is Derek Lively going to be able to play in game five? Is he playing game six? Is he playing game seven? Like, what's his availability for the rest of this series? I do disagree, though, to a point about how the Wolves are built. Yeah, they're built to compete with Denver. They've got size, obviously, to match up with Jokic, but they also have great defensive wings. Like, Anthony Edwards is an elite defender. Jaden McDaniels is an elite defender. Nikhil Alexander-Walker is a very good defender. Like, they've got guys that can get stops. Kyle Anderson is a very good defender. They've got four guys out there that you can legitimately say are upper half of the NBA type defenders. And in some cases, kind of top 10% kind of defenders. Like, they should be able to, you know, make Kyrie and make Luka somewhat inefficient. Now, I thought Luka and Kyrie missed a lot of open looks in game four. And I worry about that going into game five, because if they get those kind of looks, chances are they're going to knock them down. But I do think Minnesota has the kind of defensive depth at the wing to do to Kyrie and Luka what they did in game four. Now, there are going to be some moments where Luka just makes some impossible shots. He's one of the best shot makers I've ever seen. And Kyrie, the degree of difficulty which he can make, you know, layups off drives is friggin' wild. But, you know, this to me is a series that I think Minnesota's defense can tighten up enough that where if they get the same kind of production from Towns offensively, if they get, you know, kind of a lift like they got from the three-point line from McDaniels and Alexander Walker, I think they can find their way back in this, Mark. I do. I think game five, they're going to win big. That's my prediction. I think they win by double digits in game five. And then game six, that's where the series is going to be decided.
Yeah. I'm with you. I think that they can win game five. I think that Luka and Kyrie are going to bounce back and hit a lot more shots. That's the game changer. But I'm not going to rule out winning game five, especially being at home, the momentum. But yeah, I can't see it going past six games because of just the magnitude of it, the challenge of it, and the fact that Dallas would be on their home floor and they wouldn't want to mess around with having to then go a seventh game in Minnesota, heaven forbid. But yeah, I think that you do make a fair point about their perimeter defenders. I think Jaden McDaniels is, you know, one of the best defenders in the league, just the way that he guards perimeter players. He's very physical. You know, I know Chris Finch has often said that his impact on both sides of the floor are usually like the barometer of how well they're playing as a team, how organized they are defensively, how well the ball movement is offensively. So I've been surprised that it hasn't been as effective, but I more lean back to the fact that I'm just going to cough it up that Luka and Kyrie are just really special players, and it's tough to really limit them when you focus them on individually. But when you have both on the floor, it almost seems like it's an impossible task.
All right, so the Western Conference is going to sort itself out over the next few days. Meanwhile, Boston is just kicking back on effectively a 10-day break, which is good for them because Kristaps Porzingis needs every single day he can get. By the time the NBA Finals start next Thursday, I believe it'll be like 5 weeks since Porzingis suffered that calf injury. So he should be good to go. Like, he's been going through practice already, and getting that extra 10 days off, I think, is be valuable to them. The Celtics, look, they ran through this Eastern Conference playoffs. They lost two games in these conference playoffs. That's the positive. The negative is that people will say, well, they played depleted teams in every single round that they were in. Most recently, Indiana with Tyrese Halliburton going out midway through that series. When you look at how the Celtics have played, do you look at it like they're a team that is kind of clicking on all cylinders right now, or do you see some vulnerabilities there that a good team coming out of the West might be able to exploit?
Yeah, they're a confounding team to look at because I'm not going to be one of those guys that say, oh, they had a less bumpy road in the Eastern Conference playoffs, so they're not ready. Like, it reminded me of when people were doing that against the Golden State Warriors in 2015, and then Steph Curry said, yeah, I'm sorry we played the opponents in front of us and that we were healthy. Like, so, yeah, you play the opponents that are in front of you. The only thing that leaves me questions, no doubt, Kristaps Porzingis, when or if he's going to return, what that's going to look like, is it minute restrictions, are there any vulnerabilities there? But the second part is just, what will their best version of basketball be? I haven't seen them play at their best compared to some of the West teams with Dallas. And so with that, I would give the edge to Dallas there. But I also know on paper that Boston should be a better team because they're more experienced together. They don't really have too many on paper weaknesses. We've discussed ad nauseum. The chemistry with Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown are fine. Derek White, I think he's gotten like career highs in every statistical category here. There's continuity on the team. Once KP is back, there's going to be even more offensive synergy in terms of ball movement, floor spacing, and another dynamic passing and perimeter threat. So I think really the only vulnerability is, presuming they face Dallas, they will have to raise their game. And we've seen when Boston feels challenged, they do raise their game. You know, for better or for worse, they sometimes play with their opponent, play down to the competition. So I would think that they wouldn't do that to Dallas, but we just haven't had the opportunity to see them really have to do that so far in the playoffs because of the quality of opponents. So again, I'm not holding against it them that they faced teams like Miami, New York, and Indiana that faced serious injuries, but it has prevented us from really seeing them having to dig deep and play at an absolute high level just to win a game.
I think they needed some of the close games that they played in the conference playoffs to sharpen them going into the finals. Remember, the Celtics had like a historic point differential this year. They didn't play a lot of clutch time minutes. So when they got to the playoffs, they almost needed to use it to sharpen themselves a little bit. They got to do that a little bit in the Cleveland series. They got to do it a lot more in the Indiana series. You know, all those games except for, you know, basically game two were really competitive. The last couple, the Celtics had to storm back and win, overcoming deficits in the second half. So I think that's going to benefit them going into the finals. But I mean, man, like, all the talk about injuries this postseason, and every time the Celtics are discussed, it's rarely brought up that one of their best players only played a few games, you know, in this postseason. Like, Kristaps Porzingis was instrumental to this team's success on both ends of the floor. He was the floor spacing big offensively, and he's basically the only shot blocker they have defensively. He also is a big key to their depth. When Porzingis is out there, Al Horford goes to the bench and everybody else gets bumped down a slot. So you're not going to see O'Shea Brissett in the NBA Finals. You're going to see a lot less, probably, of Luke Kornet in the NBA Finals. You're going to see Horford off the bench. You're going to see Peyton Pritchard off the bench. And as long as he's making three-pointers, you're going to see Sam Hauser come off the bench. That's going to be an eight-man rotation that the Celtics play. I mean, the media writ large sometimes ignores the fact that the Celtics have not had one of their best players all throughout this postseason run. So I think they're going to be fine. Look, assuming it is Dallas that they play, the energy for a matchup with Kyrie is going to be off the charts. Like, that building is going to be frothing for that matchup. Like, I remember being at game two last week, and this is before, I think there was only one game in the books in the Timberwolves Mavericks series. And as fans were trickling out the exits, the concourse was filled with people screaming, "We want Kyrie!" Like, 5 years later, and nothing has changed for anybody in Boston. So the electricity of that building, I think, is going to give them a good charge. Look, they're vulnerable if Luka plays great, if Kyrie plays great, if, you know, one of the other supporting players on Dallas plays great. But they're still the favorite. You got to look at them as the favorite. Jason Tatum is having a really strong overall postseason. To me, criticism Boston is often nitpicking. Like, oh, well, you know, they're almost expected to blow out the teams that are banged up by 30. It's not how it works in the NBA. Like, in the Pacers series, like, Halliburton goes out, but, like, Andrew Nembhard stepped up and had a monster game. Like, you know, TJ McConnell has had a monster postseason. So, you know, you're not going to blow out teams in the postseason all that often, no matter where you are. So I don't look at the Celtics as being vulnerable at all. All right, last thing I want to hit you on. We are still wondering when the Lakers are going to make a coaching hire. All indications to me, Mark, are that J.J. Redick is the guy. And I've heard some stuff about, you know, I've heard some other executives tell me that they think the Lakers are going to have a coaching staff around J.J. Redick put in place before they even make the announcement of Redick being hired as the head coach. I actually think James Borrego, who has been discussed as a potential head coach, I think there's a decent chance he winds up on the bench as an assistant to J.J. Redick. So let me ask you this. Do you think J.J. is the front runner? And is that the right hire at this time for the L.A. Lakers?
Yeah, the first part of your question, yes, he's the front runner. If I had to guess when it will happen, it's going to be happening at some point after the NBA Finals ends, before the NBA draft. Partly because of the fact that J.J. Redick is doing the broadcasting duties, partly because this gives the Lakers time to not owe additional money to another head coach, and also gives them time to go through the interview process. To what you were saying, they've been interviewing candidates not just from what they say of due diligence of entertaining all head coaching possibilities. It's also having conversations with those same candidates about how they would feel about being part of a coaching staff. And, you know, the message from them is that that's also applied to J.J. Redick, but I think all signs have indicated that he will be the head coach. And now it's just about figuring out among those other candidates that they've talked to, okay, who would be good lead assistant coaches? Who would be good player development coaches? I think.
And there are some good coaches out there, Mark. I mean, I mentioned Borrego. Scott Brooks is also available after not having, you know, well, I don't think Sam Cassell is going to go. Like, I think Sam Sam, I think, has a good gig in Boston. Look, Sam has a pretty good chance of getting bumped up the bench next year with Charles Lee going somewhere else. But there are some you know, high-quality, experienced coaches. And I think that's going to be a big key. That is a big key for the Lakers as they start to piece together a J.J. Redick staff. Like, there's going to be a lot of criticism about him being a new head coach or a new coach at any level above, like, AAU. I think they're going to want to show people that they have an experienced staff around him that can guide him through some of the bumpy stuff.
Yeah. And so answer the question fully. Is he the right head coach? I have skepticism, but it has less to do with J.J. Redick and more to do with the Lakers dynamic. Because whoever is the head coach, and all signs again point to J.J. Redick, they're inheriting a team that's trying to do multiple things at once. You know, squeeze some championship run window with LeBron James because it's LeBron James, pave the way for Anthony Davis to then be the number one guy, and also develop some of their younger players on the fly. And that's is seemingly impossible to do, especially with the fact that's the Lakers and they haven't had a track record of being, you know, patient with head coaches ever since Phil Jackson's retirement in 2011. The other thing that I think we also have to keep in mind is there's been messaging put out that, oh, well, J.J. Redick could follow the same path that Pat Riley did or that Steve Kerr did. And the comparisons aren't apt at all. There are so many apples to oranges here where Pat Riley, yes, he jumped from the broadcast booth to head coaching, but in between, he was an assistant coach with the Lakers before he got that head coaching position. And he inherited the Showtime Lakers where, you know, they're already winning championships. They're all in their prime. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was a veteran, but he's still playing at a high level. Here with the Lakers, completely different dynamic of LeBron's last few years. Anthony Davis, he's been healthier, but you never quite know if that can last. And then a lot of decent role players, but that are also inconsistent. The Steve Kerr comparison also isn't apt because before he became the Warriors head coach, he had front office experience, not the same as being part of a coaching staff, but he had a window on how coaching staffs work. The other thing is he inherited a team with Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, all in their prime and just ready to make that next push after Mark Jackson helped, you know, really give them a defensive identity stamp. So this pathway that J.J. Redick's going through is going to be very unique because of what I just said. And so while I am a fan of J.J. Redick, I think he's a great basketball mind, former player. He can relate to LeBron James and, you know, other role players. I just think that what he's stepping himself into is not going to be conducive for long-term success, no matter what they do with protecting the blind spots with having good assistants around them.
Can we be real about something too? Like, this is not a good job. You know, I mean, Cleveland is a really good job. I'd even argue Charlotte is a good job, because Charlotte has LaMelo Ball, Brandon Miller, draft capital, cap space, all that. The Lakers are going nowhere. Like, I mean, can we just be real about that? Like, they had an all-NBA season or seasons from Anthony Davis and LeBron James last year, and they still got stuck in the play-in tournament, and they still got busted up by the Nuggets in the first round. The chances of them getting those types of seasons again from Anthony Davis and LeBron James are not great. Give AD props for staying healthy like he has over the last season and a half, two seasons. But he's past 30, and he's got a history of injuries, and LeBron James is going to be 40 coming up in December. You just can't keep counting on these guys to be playing at all NBA level. I know what people will say. Well, they're going to get somebody this summer. And they might, right? They've got potentially three first-round draft picks to deal on draft night. They've got a couple of movable contracts. But the suggestion, the idea that, like, for example, Trae Young, if you swap him for Austin Reeves and, you know, D'Angelo Russell and three first-round draft picks, that that is going to push you into the elite of the Western Conference is crazy. Like, that is crazy. Look at the Western Conference right now. Oklahoma City was the number one seed this year. They are going to get better. next year. Organically, they're going to get better, and more than likely, they're going to use one of their 412 draft picks to get somebody that helps them in ways that they need help. Denver, they're going to be back. Dallas, they're going to be back. Minnesota, they're going to be back. To say nothing of the teams behind the Lakers that are moving up the rankings. Houston is going to be better. San Antonio is going to be better. New Orleans might make some moves. I'm not so sure what to make of them, but you know, they're more likely than not going to be better with a healthy Zion. I don't know how you win with this team. I don't know how you do it. I don't know what move you can point to them making that says they're anything but a play-in team next year. Because again, great seasons from AD and LeBron. Still a play-in team. Still got wiped out in the first round. Mark, I don't know, all the narrative around like who's going to be the head coach and what kind of deal are they going to make, I don't think it matters. I mean, they could put Pat Riley back on that bench, and I don't think it would matter. They could make any trade that would get any one of the available players that are out there, whether it's, you know, the two guys in Atlanta, Young and Murray. Hypothetically, let's just throw Paul George into that mix. Maybe make a trade with the Warriors. I'm just throwing stuff out there for Draymond. Like, none of this puts them on a level or on the same level as the teams I just mentioned at the top of the Western Conference. Do you disagree?
No, I completely agree. And I think to further illustrate this, and I say this not as a criticism of LeBron James or Anthony Davis, it's more of a validation that it can't fall on them. It would be foolish for the Lakers or any NBA fan to think, oh, well, LeBron James has still played at a high level. He's going to continue to replicate that. Anthony Davis was a beacon of relatively good health last season. He's going to replicate that. I know ever since LeBron James has made those finals runs, it's the old adage, you never bet against LeBron. But I think in fairness to him, it can't be set up that LeBron James has to play at his absolute best at an all-star caliber level, all NBA first team level, just to have a fighter's chance. It has to be, okay, we have enough good players that we can scale back the minutes. And as we saw last season, that idea coming into preseason went away after the first game. The second thing with Anthony Davis, I know that the Lakers will say, yeah, well, he really has improved his offseason regimen and he's a lot more aggressive. And I will validate that. But again, his injury history is his injury history. And so I think the point that you're making here is that this is setting themselves up, regardless of whether they make reasonably good moves or marginal moves, that's going to require them to be mostly healthy and mostly dominant on a night-to-night basis. And that's not setting themselves up to succeed.
And even that doesn't guarantee anything. It guarantees nothing for this team. I don't get it. I mean, I've talked to enough coaches that who have told me, like, if they were interviewing for the Lakers job and they were asked what to do with this group, it would be trade everybody. Like, start over. Like, I know that's difficult because they've given away a lot of their draft picks over the next 4 or 5 years. But, you know, the holding on to LeBron and AD for the hope that you can cling to a 6, 7, or 8 seed for the right to get battered around in the first round again. I don't get what that does for anybody, right? Like, I don't get it. Like, I understand LeBron is the biggest star in the game and you want him wearing your uniform, partly for financial reasons, because he's worth it. He's worth every nickel that you are ultimately going to pay him. But I just don't get, from a basketball perspective, how that gets you closer to a championship goal. Like, that window to me isn't closing. It is completely closed right now for the Lakers.
Yeah. And look, as we know with the Lakers, financial and business decisions are a major factor in their decisions. But I will say, in fairness, and this is their internal thinking, we clearly view otherwise, but you know, this isn't the equivalent of how they operated with Kobe Bryant with, hey, let's just enjoy the farewell tour. I think through their lens, it's, hey, LeBron James is still playing at a high level. And as long as he's playing at a high level, technically, no matter how slightly slim the odds are, there is that pathway to still be a championship contender, even if it requires so many things to have to go right. And so that's where they're operating on that vantage point. I think there's also a feeling that to do that, not just from a business standpoint, from a basketball standpoint, they don't have the patience to do it. and they feel like it would just be very difficult to go into asset collecting mode and make that kind of potential change work in the long run.
Yeah, well, it's not easy. It's painful. Like, but look at the teams that have gone through it. Like, the team that's in the finals right now, the Celtics, have gone through it. Minnesota went through it. Dallas, to a degree, went through it. You can't avoid it. Like, you can't, like, unless you're Miami, you can't keep putting Band-Aids on bullet holes and waiting for, you know, this, you know, something big to happen that springboards you back to the top. I understand the Lakers are in a big market. Everybody wants to be a Laker. Everybody wants to play in LA. But you have got an aging team that lacks athleticism, that lacks shooting, and I don't think Trae Young is going to solve all those problems. Putting aside for, you know, just for the record, I'm not sure they can even get Trae Young. Like, Trae Young goes on the market, and there's going to be teams with better offers out there for him. Teams with more draft capital, teams with better young talent. Like, if Atlanta really goes the full rebuild route, and I think that's probably likely what they're going to try to do, you're going to be teams with better offers to go get Trae Young. Like, if I'm San Antonio, and I'm sitting there with, what, 4-8 in this year's draft, and I've got, you know, some decent young players and a whole bunch of draft picks, some of them Atlanta's, to potentially give back to them, that'd be a player I'd probably go after to play alongside Victor Wembanyama. Like, if you're Cleveland, like, I don't know if you want to go small guard again. Maybe you go get DeJounte Murray to play next to, you know, Donovan Mitchell in a Darius Garland deal. Like, there's just so many other potential trades that make more sense for a team like Atlanta or other teams that have an asset to deal. So,
well, the Lakers are in the ultimate, they're chasing their own tail predicament, because what you just said will also apply if Cleveland and Donovan Mitchell can't agree to that extension. They then conclude, okay, let's see what he's available. I don't think they have anything Cleveland would want besides draft picks, but that's not going to be enough. I think when you're looking at the Lakers roster, they're all decent role players, but I think that they can only make marginal moves out of them. The only sweetener of value are those draft picks, but you still, again, need to attach significant players. But then that goes back to the circular discussion that the Lakers have internalized ever since winning the championship in 2020, and also the Russell Westbrook fiasco, that they've determined they have a better chance competing with LeBron James and Anthony Davis if they have roster depth versus a third star. So if they somehow pull off that third star, but it's all veteran minimum guys, even if it's a better fit than Russ wound up being, it's still that predicament of they're only an injury away from this completely falling apart, as well as not having enough reinforcements just to fulfill positional needs.
Yeah, it's... I mean, if we're sitting here talking this time next year about the Lakers, I feel like we're having the exact same conversation, that they didn't have enough. And now we're talking about a soon to be 41-year-old LeBron James. And, you know, what kind of team can you put around him at that point? All right, Mark Medina, check him out over at Sports Kita, Fox Sports Radio. Mark, I'll let you go back to penning your opus on Tatum and Brown and the body language between the two. What does that mean? Are they friends or are they enemies? Coming to a Mark Medina byline very soon.
Great content, Chris. We can never beat that dead horse enough. I will leave you at this. I had my own playoff shortcomings. Boston's pathway was not with New York. Obviously, Miami, Cleveland, Indiana. But I'll blame it on playoff attrition. But I will leave you with this. I am looking forward to seeing Kyrie Irving, you know, do the sage routine in the garden.
Oh,
again.
Yeah.
See if he stomps on the leprechaun this time. And
Get ready to relitigate the 18-19 season. I'm already doing it. Like, I'm ready to go. Like, I am good to go if and when Dallas eliminates Minnesota. Just one final thought on the pathway thing. Like, I took some shit last year for saying that I didn't think Nikola Jokic's playoff run was an all-time great playoff run, in part because he didn't have to go through like a murderer's row in the postseason. He went through Minnesota, which was a young team, Phoenix, which was down Chris Paul for more than half that series, the Lakers, we know they weren't as good as advertised. Then they play the 8-seed Heat in the NBA Finals. So if you're going to sit there and pontificate about the Celtics' path to the finals, you've also got to go back and say, all right, well, Jokic and the Nuggets had the exact same path, exact same type of path, where they played, you know, not exactly a peer at any point during the postseason. That's...
I will say this. The Celtics are going to play a better caliber of opponent in the finals than Denver did with Miami. I mean, Miami's great, but they overachieved. But since you're on this topic, I mean, do you want to do the victory lap? You're saying, yeah, Denver's not a dynasty.
No, I'm not a victory. Because, like, dynasties, like, they could still do it next year. Like, they were one crappy half away from being the prohibitive favorite to win a championship. So, like, I'm not – nobody's counting the Nuggets out. It's just like, you know, turnabout is fair play, right? They had a relatively easy path to the finals, and they took advantage of it. You can only play the teams that are in front of you. They didn't ask Boston to choke away, you know, a conference finals against the Heat in 2023. But, like, the people that are criticizing the Celtics for who they played to get to this point, you have to go back and look at who the Nuggets played as well. It's a very similar type of situation with Boston and with Denver. All right, Mark, good stuff, man. We'll do it again soon. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Safe travels. Whoa.